You're in tune with What It Is on WNCW. I'm Joe Kendrick, joined by Jeff Eason and Carol Rifkin. Today, we're talking about artists who are ahead of their time, and there's a lot of history of musicians and artists who didn't really get a lot of recognition for some of the innovations or styles that they put forward, only to have folks come around later on and capitalize on that. Also, a lot of history of artists who weren't necessarily overlooked, but had just been, maybe a decade or so ahead of the curve. That's what we're talking about today on WNCW's What It Is.
Yeah, Joe. I mean, I think it would be very easy to point out people like Frank Zappa or Jimi Hendrix as people who were ahead of their time because of how much influence they had with music makers afterwards. But if I had to pick one, it would be Gram Parsons. I mean, he's been dead over 35 years, and nearly every Americana band that comes along has him as one of their primary influences. If you listen to Gillian Welch and David Rawlings, you can hear Gram Parsons in there. If you listen to Old Crow Medicine Show, you can hear Gram Parsons in there. And you have to realize he only put out two albums of his own, and then a handful with the Flying Burrito Brothers, and then there's some posthumous releases. And yet his voice is one of the leading forces of the Americana movement even today.
You can hear a lot of his rhythmical music in the contemporary singer-songwriters, too, in Americana. You can almost hear a little bit of that in the Avett Brothers, or just the rhythm of the music.
And the harmonies as well. I would say that a lot of the stuff that he did harmonically when he brought in Emmylou Harris is sort of that kind of sweet, angelic, secondary voice on top of his more realistic, down-to-earth voice that's been copied endless times.
Well, I think in old-time music and the folk market, for sure, most of the people in it aren't recognized and didn't get famous, and someone else did. Frank Proffitt is a really great example, who did the arrangement of Lay Down Your Head, Tom Dula, that the Kingston Trios heard somebody sing in a bar and made billions of copies of, and eventually he was credited for it. I mean, they didn't even know that the song came from somebody. They heard somebody singing in a bar and didn't even know it was a North Carolina folk song that someone had a real famous arrangement of. So there's lots of that in old-time music.
I wonder how much if they really knew that it was based on a true story from Western North Carolina.
No, but I interviewed them for a story for the newspaper one time, and they actually came to North Carolina and went to North Wilkesboro, to his town, because they wanted to find out more about it. They were so intrigued when the whole history started to happen. And they did go there and talk to people and find out more about it as they were passing through.
I think another good example in this is Raymond Scott, who had pioneered what later became cartoon music, and Warner Brothers and Carl Stallings, who had taken a lot of Raymond Scott compositions and later used them for Bugs Bunny cartoons and such. But Raymond Scott, a great composer and inventor who was very popular in his day in the 30s, had a band with big names like Bunny Berrigan, but really is not a household name whatsoever, and made music that really was appropriated for cartoons after the fact. Also a great inventor. Invented the electronium, which was pretty much like an early synthesizer, but it didn't have a keyboard. He also invented things like the Karloff, which was an early sampler, and basically put forward music that was what would later be known as ambient music. He did a lot of a series of musics that was like music for babies, and music that was designed to help babies in certain stages of development sleep and play, and was real, really far ahead of his time. You know, maybe 10 or 15 years later, Brian Eno would take that idea, or, you know, a Philip Glass or a Terry Riley or somebody came along and became better known for that sort of style. But check out some music from Raymond Scott next time you get a chance.
Yeah, that's a good point, that those early composers for the Warner Brothers cartoons and some of those other cartoons were just way ahead of their time. And I can't imagine that there would be a Frank Zappa or a Danny Elfman in particular if they had not kind of spread their influence and made music that was both classical, jazzy, and very visual as well.
There were a lot of women who set the stage for contemporary Americana, too. Rose Maddox was a huge star in her day, and yet today she's not really that well known. But if you go back and look through the country music costume books, it was she who inspired Nudie to do probably some of the greatest costumes, and she who really made wearing those costumes on stage a really big deal. He started doing that in California before he even moved to Nashville. And she really set the standard in a lot of songs, too, for that sort of stuff that maybe Hazel Dickens or Loretta Lynn and other people became, particularly Loretta Lynn, became famous for later. Rose Maddox, really, and the Maddox brothers did a little bit earlier, never quite probably got the recognition for it in contemporary music.
So we can credit Rose Maddox with the nudie suit?
Not really. We can credit her, I think, for making it really popular. There's a lot of stories. I have this wonderful book about the history of the costumes in music. And, you know, it's about supply and demand. She wore them and loved them. And he was making them with someone else early on. He was in California before he was in Nashville. And she wanted fancier ones. You know, it was she that really got the ball rolling. Every time she got something fancier, everybody else would get something fancier, and some of Nudie's most famous suits were made for her early on. She had spectacular clothing, and not only that, she and her brothers would roll up in their own car, and I'm sorry to say I can't remember the make. That's like the guys would say, how could you not remember the make? But it was something really special, like their own Cadillac or something. They'd all roll into town in a new suit. It was part of their persona, and in separate cars. So there was a lot of that going on. She was a huge star, and it's kind of faded from history unless you're a junkie like me.
That would be a good topic for another day, is sort of like the evolution of the performance costumes in music, you know, and how,
Definitely, I want to be
the
there for that.
The performers of the Grand Ole Opry
right.
and places like
yeah.
that really led the way before rock and rollers were even invented.
Well, I've got an example in that direction of an artist ahead of their time for that whole sort of stage persona, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, who was outlandish way, way before it was even remotely acceptable. And so artists like Little Richard and many others, I think, went on and were extremely successful with this really over-the-top presentation. But Screamin' Jay Hawkins was doing things in the late 40s, you know, like popping out of coffins on stage. He had a flaming skull that would be on stage and was best known for that drunken version of I Put a Spell on You, which was recorded when he was fairly well inebriated, and a few other tunes. But Screamin' Jay Hawkins, who went on and had a really successful career, but, you know, definitely not nearly well known as folks like Little Richard.
There are other folks that did the costume thing, too, that were famous on the Opry that really set the stage for later people that nobody remembers now. Like, I mean, did you ever hear of Ferland Husky? He wore suits on the Opry with huskies all over him, kind of from Nudie. But he did a lot of early country stuff that people followed with, and he kind of faded but set the stage for a lot of people to really do a lot of later country music.
And it's easy for us to now, when we see these old black and white films of like the Opry and everything like that, you might think that these costumes were all black and white and gray, but no, they were made for live audiences. And if you see the old photographs that just happen to be in color, they're bright reds and bright greens all the way through them.
There's a lot of other styles that were affected as well, and this is one we really ought to let Dennis in on. But for example, Snuffy Jenkins, right here in this county, was playing a banjo style like Earl Scruggs. But Earl Scruggs was the one who really got really famous for it. But if you talk to people here, they'll say that Snuffy Jenkins also played that in the same time, but didn't get credit for it. So who knows?
Another artist I think that deserves mention is Shuggie Otis, who was, I think, the first to use a drum machine in music, and this was in the early 70s. Now, Shuggie Otis,
his fault, huh?
yeah. Now, he had a measure of success. It's probably his best-known tune was covered by the Brothers Johnson in Strawberry Letter 23, and he's also known for somewhat famously turning down a gig in the Rolling Stones, and his career quickly took a nosedive thereafter, and then came back in the past decade. He had a comeback and did some touring, but a great songwriter, a man who was, you know, gifted and knew it all, you know, from early on. It didn't really need much formal training whatsoever, but is not nearly as big of a name as he probably could have been.
Yeah, he was sort of Prince before Prince was Prince in a way, as far as like getting in the studio and creating these funky grooves and creating songs all by himself, you know, and putting out albums with very little outside help.
What do you think? Email us whatitis@wncw.org. Some favorite examples that you might have of artists who were ahead of their time. For Public Radio, I'm Joe Kendrick, joined by Carol Rifkin and Jeff Eason. Until next time.